And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO with Martin Willis and Michael Lauck. Please remember to visit the website, podcastufo.com. Check out the latest blogs and forums. And while you're there, don't forget to like our very active Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. Michael Lauck will be joining us in a sec for the news. Today's podcast is number 72. We have an enjoyable guest, Nick Redfern. He'll talk about his new book, which is basically on missing government files worldwide. Very interesting. And I'll also ask him about his thoughts on the Roswell case and a lot more. So, Michael, what's going on with the news?
We actually have a pretty busy news week, starting with a new book that explores how aliens may develop and look. Don Lincoln's new book, Alien Universe, will explore our fictional stories of alien civilizations and the possible ways real intelligent life may develop on other planets. Lincoln is, by trade, a physicist, and said in an NBC interview, "It is not just fiction. It is not just pretend. There's some real scientific thinking going on." The book is now available on Amazon.
Yes, I embedded the movie clip that's in that right on the show notes. It's a really interesting little clip by NBC News. And also, I kind of like this guy. I'd like to get him on the show. He says his book's not aimed at ufology per se, but he makes a lot of nice scientific points, and I like that type of thing. Like to have him on.
All right. The Heartland UFO Summit. The Heartland UFO Summit was last weekend, at least if you are listening to this podcast close to its Friday, November 1st release date. It had a great lineup, including Richard Dolan and organizer Sam Maranto. So for a special report on how it went, here is Sam Maranto.
Well, thanks, Mike. It was a great turnout as far as people and interesting ideas. My God, people had questions left and right. And Richard, of course, always does a stellar job. Of course, with us also was David Mahler with his new book on triangular UFOs, an assessment of the situation. Then we had, of course, our good friend Donald Schmidt talking about revelations from Roswell and his new book on the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. We also had a gentleman who hasn't made his appearance in some time, physicist and scientific ufologist Vic Connor, who spoke about different scientific principles and, of course, our extension into travel and how things are basically moving quicker than we think. So the thought of speed of light travel is something more practical and a possibility than what we may think. And a civilization far more advanced than us may very well be doing that.
And one of the people you just mentioned, well, actually a couple of them, hopefully will be on the show soon. I've been going back and forth with Richard Dolan, trying to get him on. And also David Mahler, love to have him on the show about triangular UFOs. There seems to be a lot going on with those type of vehicles spotted up in the sky.
Yep. In Illinois, we had a number of cases. Of course, he worked on the 2000 January 4th and 5th case. And we also have new developments on that case. We have witnesses that came forward just in the last year who seen the object earlier that evening in Plainfield and one individual in Berwyn, Illinois.
Is that the Tinley Park?
Nope. This is the UFOs over Illinois, the police officers chasing the large triangular object. We also have a gentleman who was a fire, what was he, a fire chief? Or he had some, I forgot what his designation was in the fire department. But anyways, in Missouri that evening, they also chased it through a number of states and were directly underneath it with a number of police officers. Unfortunately, their video cameras did not tilt up, so they were unable to videotape it, but they had descriptions like you wouldn't believe, and the gentleman actually makes a model of it, or made a number of models, and you know, this is clearly not a conventional aircraft by any stretch of the imagination. Anybody thinking that, well, just get the information.
Yeah. Well, Sam, it's always a pleasure talking to you, and we'll definitely have you back on the show sometime.
Thanks, Sam.
Thank you much.
All right, thanks for checking in.
Dark matter detector has found nothing. Scientists with the Large Underground Xenon, or LUX, dark matter experiment, which runs what is believed to be the most sensitive dark matter detector ever built, have announced that in the first 3 months they have found nothing. This lack of discovery is actually important because it eliminates certain particles theorized to make up dark matter. The LUX experiment will run through the end of next year.
You know, if I was a betting man, maybe we should open like online betting on this, whether they're going to find it or not. I got $20 saying they'll never find anything.
Are you sure you know what you're getting into with that?
I'll contact my lawyer after we record, but I think online betting, we can bet yay or nay on dark matter. I got $20 down.
I got 20 that says that we will eventually figure out an explanation for dark matter.
No. That's a gray area. You got a gray area and dark matter. That's not good. No.
But dark matter is itself just insert mass here to solve a group of equations to figure out the right. I mean, it's a very open-ended thing. So I say we find a solution.
No, it's detecting dark matter. Detecting. That's what I'm laying my $20 on.
Well, the problem is, what if dark matter is something we already know of but did not know that it could exist in a way that it hasn't been detected yet? What if what dark matter is the fact that everything is so much bigger than we initially thought, or that certain things, as you get out to the edge of the universe, are for some reason much more massive than we believe them to be? That all those could actually be, in their own weird way, dark matter. So I say we come up with a solution. And I also say eventually. I'm not capping it. So there.
It sounds like you're a little soft on the betting. Okay, here's how the betting goes out there. It's either dark matter exists and they find it with this detector, or they don't. So I got $20 saying they don't, and we'll leave it at that. Are we still friends?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
All right, so let's move on.
Blimp scans Colorado River. A white blimp known as Skyship 600 or Cloud Lab has been cruising the skies over the Colorado River collecting data for an upcoming BBC documentary. The 68-foot-tall airship is traveling from coast to coast and may inspire UFO reports in areas not expecting to see a blimp in the air. If you see a UFO, you might want to check and see if the BBC's Cloud Lab is in your area.
You know, I've seen a lot of blimps, like in San Francisco area where I lived for a number of years. You see them out there all the time. And, you know, I never once thought, oh, that's a UFO. They're pretty distinct. You know, I don't know how you could possibly mistake one, but...
Well, actually, this past couple weeks, I live in St. Louis, and we've had, you know, World Series games and National League Championship games, and we've had a blimp popping around over Busch Stadium downtown that, because of the way it's backlit by the giant message screen that's aimed down at the crowd, it does look really weird from a distance. It looks very ovular from a distance. It does not look like a blimp. And I tried several times to get pictures of it, but the weirdest thing I thought personally was, although I could see it very clearly because of the lights of the city, if I took a picture, it wouldn't show up.
Ah. The alien conspiracy.
In reverse.
Yes.
And finally, the New England UFO Conference draws about 270. The first annual New England UFO Conference was last Saturday, and according to newspaper reports, organizer Steve Fermani reported 270 attendees. We have links to a couple of different newspaper articles on the event, none of which, unfortunately, mention Martin Willis. But he was in attendance. So, Martin, how was it?
Well, you know, it was really great. Now, I didn't really have any place to set up. There was no table for me to set up this time. However, there was one upstairs that I got to meet some great people. I'll talk about that in a second. So I didn't really have exposure there. I did have my cards out. I did talk to a couple people that listened to the show there. But again, nobody, you know, I just didn't really it just didn't really work out the way I thought it was going to. But here's the good thing. I went upstairs where I was supposed to go, had a table up there with Ben and Paul Eno, and they have a radio show that's listened to in several cities called Behind the Paranormal. I'm actually going to be on their show November 17th, which is a Sunday night at 7 to 8 p.m. And I recorded a clip with them. It's a father-son team, and really pleasant, really nice people. And here's the clip right here. All right, I'm actually giving a little plug here because I'm with these great guys here at the New England UFO Conference. And I am with Paul and Ben Eno, and they have Behind the Paranormal, which is, you're out of Rhode Island, is that right?
That's yeah, correct, Mark.
Yeah, unfortunately.
And let's hear about your associated with CBS Radio. And can you talk a little bit about your show? And I'll put this in our news segment.
Well, thank you, Martin. Yes, we have two versions of the show, Behind the Paranormal with Paul and Ben Eno, on Sunday evenings. We are in four cities, Boston, Pittsburgh, Detroit, and Seattle, on the CBS New Sky part of the CBS network. And on Mondays, we're on a New England station, WOON, 1240 a.m. Out of northern Rhode Island, serves the Boston Providence
and market. ONWorldwide.com.
And ONWorldwide.com.
And could someone listen to your show as a podcast?
Everybody can. If you really want to check it out, you can go to www.behindtheparanormal.com. And we have over 500 free podcasts on there. They're all free for download. Yeah, you can just pick them up, listen to them whenever you want. We've had people who are trying to go through all of the podcasts at once, and they're having a lot of trouble trying to get to it.
You too, and I have interviewed a lot of the same people. But let's talk quickly about the Rendlesham Forest situation. That's amazing.
It gets brought up every time we're anywhere, basically.
Well, that's true. Well, we actually visited Rendlesham Forest last year and with Larry Warren, one of the prime witnesses, and he showed us around the place and at night and during the day. And it was quite an experience to be there, having covered this case, really, I think, more than any radio or television show in the world over a period of 16 hours on CBS and on an internet station. Those podcasts are all available on our website. And we're particularly interested in hot spots, flap areas, because our theory, at least from my experience, and starting out as a ghost researcher while studying for the priesthood, was that the areas are never isolated. You never have a haunted house, quote unquote. It's always an entire area that's affected, sometimes with UFO experiences as well and sightings, things of this kind. And we're working on several cases like that right now, and we think Rendlesham might be one of those places.
We talked earlier, and you like to keep the integrity up like I like to on this show, and that's appreciated. So I'm sure our listeners would enjoy checking your show out.
Alrighty.
Well, thank you, Martin, and it was great to get to know you, and thank you for the plug.
Yeah, it was wonderful meeting you.
Great. So that's it for the news, right, Michael?
That's all we have for this week.
Yeah, thanks so much, and really, you got to listen to Nick Redfern. It's a great show.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it.
And I want to say next week we have a gentleman named Mark D'Antonio, and he is an astronomer. He's also the chief photo analyst for MUFON. That's another good show coming up, podcast number 73. Thanks, Michael, and I'll talk to you next week.
Thank you. Talk to you next week.
I'm with Nick Redfern. Nick, where are you? You're in Texas, aren't you?
Yeah, I live in Arlington, which is just about roughly halfway between Dallas and Fort Worth.
Yes, and how long ago did you move over from England?
About 12 or 13 years ago, something like that. So I've been here quite a long time now.
Yeah, and right off the bat, we're going to be talking about your book, which is For Nobody's Eyes Only, Missing Government Files and Hidden Archives, that document behind the truth of the most enduring. That's a long title, huh?
Yeah, New Page Books, who publish it, for some reason, they really like to sort of have long subtitles, which sort of gets to the heart of the crux of the book, I guess.
And you are a publisher of many books. How many books in total have you written?
I think I've done about 26, 27, something like that. But I've always got sort of one or two books on the go in terms of writing them. So, and I've been doing that. I've been writing books for about 20 years, but worked sort of in the field of journalism for about 25 altogether.
Yeah. Now, I know you you write on all kinds of topics, which are, I think are quite fascinating, and UFOs are one of those topics. What got you interested in, let's just say, things out of the box, the paranormal or whatever?
Sure.
What started you on that path?
Well, I guess unlike a lot of people in the UFO field, I've never actually seen a UFO personally. You know, a lot of people do get involved in the subject because they have that sort of life-changing experience, but mm-hmm. for me, it was my father who worked in the British Royal Air Force on radar, and he was involved in a couple of UFO incidents where the radar guys tracked very fast-moving objects flying at high speed, high level, high altitude, approaching the British coastline, and this was at the height of a NATO exercise in the 1950s called Mainbrace. And the first thought was, well, it's got to be the Russians launching some sort of sneak attack. And so aircraft were launched from a nearby Air Force base, and the pilots reported seeing strange lights in the sky, but they couldn't get close to them. And it was almost as if the UFOs played a sort of game of cat and mouse with the air crews. And eventually they were forced to return to base when they ran low on fuel. And this occurred over the course of 3 nights, and the objects were never identified, but they were clearly performing maneuvers that far, you know, sort of outweighed anything that either the Russians, America, or the British were flying at that time. And everybody was told not to talk about it and reminded of the fact that they'd signed the British government's Official Secrets Act, as it's called. And my dad didn't tell me till I was like 13 or 14. And when he told me, you know, that's what got me interested, not because he was just my own father, but because he was somebody trained in the Royal Air Force on radar. And so that's what prompted me to start looking into it to a greater degree.
And it sort of led you down the path of cryptozoology and all kinds of other paths as well.
Yeah.
Would you say that UFOs is one of your favorite topics in this realm?
It is, but I mean, my overall favorite one is without doubt cryptozoology, which is the study of unknown animals, like, for example, Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, the Abominable Snowman, the Chupacabra, you know, the list goes on. In other words, the unacknowledged animals that science tells us don't exist, but, you know, the witnesses tell us do exist.
Now, recently there was a study done that I just heard something about, is that they're saying, they're almost claiming like they have evidence against it, but not really. They're just revealing that they found an early form of bear hybrid or something like that. Have you been following that?
Yeah, I mean, this is a story that relates to the Abominable Snowman. It's actually not a new story, the idea being that there could be some form of large bear in the Himalayas, which is responsible for sightings of the Yeti. Now, you know, the ironic thing is that I don't think there's any cryptozoologist out there who doesn't think that sometimes, you know, bears, particularly when they're standing on hind legs and seen very fleetingly, might be mistaken for, you know, something like a Bigfoot or a Yeti. Mm-hmm. The problem is, with this particular theory, is that almost exclusively the Abominable Snowman is seen walking on two legs, you know, for a lengthy period of time. But bears don't do that. You know, they'll stand up on their hind legs, and they can certainly walk on their hind legs, but they don't do it exclusively, or even for the most part. You know, they will walk on four legs. Typically, they'll stand up to, you know, look over bushes and things like that to see what's going on, but it isn't easy for them to walk, you know, lengthy periods of time on two legs. And so that's one of the issues that's problematic. And, you know, one of the things I've talked about is finding sort of bare hairs in the area where the Yeti is believed to exist. Well, my argument is, well, so what? You know, just because there's a bear there doesn't mean there's not something else there as well. You know, it's kind of like saying Bigfoot lives in the woods of North America at the same time that bears live in the woods of North America. You know, the very fact that one animal is there doesn't rule out the possibility that there's another one there of an unknown nature as well.
You know, before we move back into the book and UFOs and all that, since we're on this subject, I'll just ask a couple of questions. And that is, is one of the arguments that you always hear is how come no one's ever found a skeleton or found, you know, found one sleeping or something like that?
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's actually a good question. And it is one of the sort of most baffling aspects of the phenomenon. And there are sort of two ways to approach it. Oh, it's actually the several ways. Of course, the skeptics would say there are no bodies because the creature doesn't exist. You know, that's the most obvious explanation. Mainstream cryptozoologists who perceive Bigfoot as just some sort of a North American equivalent of like a giant ape, and they view the abominable snowman as the, you know, an ape-like creature in the Himalayas, take the stance that, well, maybe these creatures exist only in very small numbers, and for that reason, that's why we don't find a body. Then you have the third theory, which is arguably the most controversial, that these creatures are far more sort of paranormal based than they are flesh and blood animals. You know, in essence, they're sort of like the equivalent of a ghost or something supernatural, but that takes on like a monstrous beastly form. Now, you know, the problem is we have no real proof of the sort of physicality of Bigfoot, but equally we don't have any proof of the supernatural angle. So in other words, even within the research community, there's a lot of divergence as to why we don't actually have physical evidence.
One more question that kind of ties in with everything here. You hear sometimes you hear a connection between UFOs and Bigfoot. What do you have to say about that as far as sightings?
Well, that actually sort of ties in what I mentioned about the, you know, the paranormal angle. There are actually a lot of reports on file where people have seen Bigfoot, and they've seen not so much UFOs, but sort of strange lights in the sky and weird balls of light flitting through the woods at the same time that they've seen Bigfoot, and people claim to have seen the creature like vanish in a flash of light. A friend of mine named Stan Gordon wrote an entire book on this called Silent Invasion, which deals with a wave of UFO activity in Pennsylvania in 1973, which was also dominated by sightings of Bigfoot. Now, of course, again, mainstream cryptozoologists sort of, you know, roll their eyes at these types of stories. But from my perspective, there are so many of them that it really, to me at least, does push Bigfoot down the more of a paranormal path than it does the idea that it's just the North American equivalent of a gorilla or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm. About the government, you know, if someone looks at my website about us, you'll see there that I have written that, you know, I have a feeling, or it's a possibility, I should say, that at least some part of our government knows about UFOs and is keeping it from us. Not that they might necessarily know what UFOs are, even. I know that your book basically talks about stuff like that. Can you go over the synopsis of your book?
Yeah, sure. The book is basically a study of a number of conspiracies, sort of many of them UFO-related, where we have proof or evidence that government files that should exist have either been sort of destroyed deliberately, or they've vanished, or they can't be found, or they were shredded or burned. And, you know, it's a case of sort of demonstrating the conspiracy by showing the reader that somebody has tried to wipe out the evidence to hide the story. And, you know, if this only happened once or twice, you could just put it down to, you know, just bureaucratic mistakes where somebody threw something out when they shouldn't have. But we find it all around the world where, you know, government agencies have said, well, we've gone looking for the files, but sorry, we destroyed them years ago, or they got burned, or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, the big question is who's doing this and why? And my personal view is that, you know, when people target the government and they say, well, the government are the evil people and, you know, they're preventing us from finding this information, I don't actually agree with that. I think the real sort of deep and dark secrets about the UFO subject aren't directly hidden by the government itself or even the relevant acknowledged agencies like the CIA or the FBI. I think the secrets are hidden more likely by some sort of shadow type organization that is almost like a shadow government that isn't sort of necessarily acknowledged to exist, and perhaps even Congress and people like this don't even know about it, but because it's so deeply buried in the official infrastructure. So I don't sort of portray, you know, like the FBI, the CIA, whoever is the bad guys. I don't think they're the people hiding the truth. They may ironically have a lot of data, but they may not be the people who, you know, are hiding the truth, the facts. I think that sort of goes to another much deeper level that we haven't yet even hardly begun to penetrate, I think.
Mm-hmm. So this kind of leads me to the kind of bizarre story of Chase Brandon saying he found a file box named Roswell, which is kind of bizarre. What's your take on that whole situation?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is an interesting one, and it's also kind of a vexing one as well, because it's difficult to know where the truth lies. But Chase Brandon was a man who surfaced a couple of years ago, a former CIA employee who claimed to have read or seen a document titled Roswell. Now, Brandon was the CIA's entertainment liaison officer, as it's known, with Hollywood. That's to say, you know, if a Hollywood production company wants to make a sort of big budget movie or whatever, but and there's information in there on the CIA actually has like a person who can help them, you know, understand how the agency works and the types of things it does, you know. So it's like a PR type person, but liaising with the world of entertainment. And Brandon claimed that on one particular occasion, while he was working with the CIA, he spent time in an area called the Historical Intelligence Collection, which is a real part of the CIA. It's located at the agency's headquarters in Langley, Virginia. And he said that he saw this file, which was titled Roswell. Now, he didn't actually go into too much detail, you know, with regard to what the file actually stated, but he said there were records and documents in there that basically, you know, suggested there was far more to the official story than the government had released or suggested themselves. Now, the story has provoked a lot of controversy even within the pro-Roswell community. For example, you know, the very fact that the file was titled Roswell and it was an old file is intriguing because the link between the events itself and Roswell the town, you know, is actually a very flimsy one and is really only been amplified by the UFO research community, particularly when Charles Berlitz and Bill Moore wrote the book The Roswell Incident in 1980. And by that I mean the event itself actually occurred at a place called the Foster Ranch in Lincoln County, New Mexico. Roswell, the town, is located in Chase County, Roswell. Actually, it's like a two-hour drive from the town of Roswell to the crash site.
Right.
So, in other words, the only reason why Roswell, the town, has become linked to the crash is because Roswell was where the nearest military base existed to where the wreckage could be taken. So, in other words, it's kind of strange that an official CIA document would be titled Roswell when it's actually the UFO community that is responsible for promoting the Roswell UFO link.
Right.
You know, you'd imagine that the file would really be titled something like Incident on the Foster Ranch, you know, and that would make it more sort of acceptable, I think. So even within the UFO community, it stirred up a lot of debate as to whether the story's true or not. And the CIA didn't come out when the story surfaced. They didn't come out and say that Chase Brandon was a liar. They just said they went looking for the material that he claimed to have seen and said, we can't find it. You know, so some people have suggested that might have been the CIA's tactful way of not wanting to sort of besmirch the character of one of their employees, but also not having to sort of openly comment outright on his claims. But, you know, the onus is on him to explain more. You know, he was the one that came forward with the story, and so far, you know, we're sort of limited in what information we've got.
I would think that if you had a high clearance, I understand you'd have a high clearance if you were even looking at these things, but still, I would think something like that would be numbered or some type of code word at such a top level. anyway, instead of saying just Roswell.
You're absolutely right. And to just have a file titled Roswell is almost sort of too good to be true. You know, I mean, that's the problem why I think it's been so difficult to access official files on Roswell, because people assume it's going to be under a file title like Roswell UFO Crash, which, you know, would be bizarre. You know, it would be titled something far more bureaucratic in nature, which is typically the way all agencies around the world work, you know.
Mm-hmm. The last show I just had, Michael Lauk, who does the news with me, mentioned that you had a different type of take on Roswell. Can you talk about that, if it's true?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not so much my take. What it is, I interviewed way back now, sort of 10 years ago, a number of retired and elderly military personnel who claimed that the truth of Roswell was actually nothing to do with UFOs. They claimed it was all based around high-altitude balloon experimentation in this sort of post-Second World War era, sort of 45, 46, 47, where people were being, high-altitude balloons were being launched with people on board to try and determine the effects of high-altitude exposure. You know, but this is obviously pre-space, you know, the space race, et cetera, with the Soviets, but it was sort of very early and highly secret experimentation to try and understand how the human body would react to high-altitude exposure. And that some of these experiments involved sort of gigantic balloon arrays that would take these sort of gondola-type constructions into the sky, and then they would come down and, you know, the people would be tested, etc. And supposedly, according to the people I spoke to at least, one of these huge balloons and one of these gondolas with four or five so-called passengers on board crashed to Earth off range. It was supposed to come down on the White Sands Missile Range, which is this heavily guarded area of New Mexico, a military installation. But it went off course and supposedly came down on the Foster Ranch. And in a worst-case scenario, the rancher stumbled across the wreckage and the bodies of the crew before the military could get there. And he told the local police, who then went into Roswell, and then the media picked up the story, and it all blew out of proportion before the military could get a put the lid down on it. And so they come up with this story about it being a weather balloon and a flying saucer to hide the fact that they didn't want the Russians to find out how advanced the sort of research was into high-altitude technology back in 47, you know, at the height of the beginnings, I should say, of the Cold War. Now, I'll be the first to admit that a number of the people I interviewed turned out to have backgrounds in the field of disinformation. So it's sort of, you know, were they spreading this story to hide the UFO truth, or was this the truth and the UFO angle was the cover story? And, you know, even for me, you know, even to this day, 10 years or so after I interviewed these people, actually 12 in one of the cases, I'll be the first to admit I truthfully don't know which way, you know, it goes. You know, it's one of these situations where it's so baffling and there's so many mirrors and, you know, mirrors within mirrors that you just really don't know who's telling the truth and who's creating a cover story. But that was what the gist of it was, sort of high-altitude secret balloon experiments using people.
Wow. That really does add a little bit of a mix to the whole thing, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And the problem is, you know, it's like Roswell to me is like an American equivalent of Britain's Jack the Ripper. You know, it's so long ago. There are so many different theories and claims that I'm not sure, unfortunately, unless something officially surfaces, I'm not sure we'll ever really, you know, have a full understanding or full proof of what actually occurred.
That's right. And the more the people die off that claim to have been witnesses, and the longer the time goes.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, just recently we had the unfortunate death of Jesse Marcel Jr., who was the young boy whose dad, Major Jesse Marcel, was one of the people involved in Roswell and, you know, brought some of the wreckage to the house before it was all classified to show his son. And, you know, Jesse Marcel Jr. was like 11 years old, and he just recently died. He was nearly 80. You know, and that demonstrates how long ago Roswell actually occurred. You know, it's 60, next year it'll be 67 years ago. You know, we're talking now almost about 70 years, two-thirds of a century, which makes it, you know, every year that goes by, it becomes more and more difficult to prove anything on the case, really.
Yeah, and they're still having digs. They're having a dig out there, I believe, next month.
Well, yeah, and I mean, I think this is an important thing because really the only way I think we're going to get to the bottom of Roswell is through some alternative fashion. You know, I mean, nothing's ever surfaced on the case apart from one or two, literally one or two pages of documentation, which don't, you know, they're not smoking guns. They actually just talk about the press release the military put out and, you know, this weather balloon angle. So I think the only way the truth is likely to surface is if whoever's hiding the truth decides to release it. And I don't see what their motivation would be for doing that because they clearly don't want to do that. So I think there are two possibilities. One would be that something surfaces by mistake. That's to say, perhaps a document or a file got misfiled and it surfaces one day and then, you know, blows the whole thing wide open. Perhaps, you know, somebody requests something through the Freedom of Information Act and it's mistakenly released. And the other scenario is, you know, in connection with things like this dig that's going to go ahead where people will be digging out at the original crash site and trying to, you know, find remnants and scraps of material that might have got buried or, you know, ended up in a, even something like a rabbit hole or something, you know, just blew in there 70 years ago and still wedged inside one of these sort of an underground crevice or whatever. And, I mean, the chances of finding something might be slim. But on the other hand, I think if we don't go looking, we're definitely not going to find anything. So in that sense, it's worth at least trying.
That's right. Now, have you been following the people that claim they have two slides of Roswell aliens? Have you been following that at all?
Yes, I have. I know a few little bits about it, but I haven't seen anything. You know, there's this claim that there is like a slide or two which shows something like a body. And I mean, if it surfaces, I mean, that would be great. You know, and I think the problem is a great deal of debate and controversy and conversation is going on about this before really hardly anybody has actually seen it. And I think that's the problem. It's led to all sorts of wild rumors and inaccurate rumors. But, you know, it does come down to the fact that, you know, these slides do exist. The big question is what they show and, you know, will we see them? And are they actually related, you know, to the Roswell story directly?
That's right. And I think that would be the most difficult part to tie in is if they related to Roswell or not.
Yeah, I mean, these are bigger issues that I think the so-called Dream Team, which is comprised of various Roswell researchers, you know, they're looking into it and have been and have uncovered some intriguing information. But, you know, I guess for the rest of us, it's really sort of a case of wait and see what surfaces and when it surfaces, you know.
In your experience in researching the UFO field, what is the most intriguing case in your mind?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of them. I would say pretty much near the top of the list, though, would be what I would consider to be like a British Roswell, and that was the series of UFO landings and encounters in Rendlesham Forest on the east coast of England in December 1980, where over the course of December the 26th to the 28th, there were multiple UFO encounters in Rendlesham Forest, which backs onto two military bases, Bentwaters and Woodbridge, which are now closed down. But back in 1980, they're both British Royal Air Force bases, but one was leased out to an American contingent, you know, in the event that, again, the Soviets launched a sneak attack, that it would help, you know, sort of defend any assault on mainland Europe. But what's intriguing about the Rendlesham story, and the reason I include this in the book, is because there's demonstrable evidence that files on the case have vanished. I mean, one classic example is that if we look at the story of a man named George Wilde. George Wilde had a senior position in the British prison service at the time the Rendlesham case occurred. And he spoke with senior personnel who told him that a nearby prison called High Point Prison was primed for evacuation at the height of the UFO encounters. And Georgina Bruni, who was also a Rendlesham researcher who wrote a book called You Can't Tell the People, all about the case, she found evidence of two further prisons which were primed for evacuation on the same night, suggesting that something very serious was going down to where the government was in a panic state and was, getting ready to evacuate, but not just the prisoners, but also possibly the people from the local towns and villages. Now, that in itself is an intriguing story alone, but a few years ago, about 10 years ago now, the late Lord Hill Norton, who was a former British Chief of Defence Staff, he actually tabled the British government and said, you know, I want to see the governor's logbook from High Point Prison for December 1980 to see if there's anything in there about this planned evacuation of High Point Prison. And the government grudgingly, even though he was a former defense chief of defense staff, the government was quite grudgingly willing to look into it. So they went looking, and what they found was that the logbook for December 1980 has gone. It's just vanished, like so many of these other cases. And again, when that happens, for me, you know, I just cannot put that down to coincidence or accident. You know, the very logbook that could confirm these events is gone. And that's what we've seen time and time again in the UFO field, that significant documents that should exist seemingly don't exist anymore.
And this is worldwide, obviously. So this is pretty amazing when you really think about it.
Yeah, and I mean, just to go back to Roswell, I mean, in 1993, the U.S. New Mexico State Congressman, Stephen Schiff, approached the what was at the time was called the General Accounting Office. Today it's called the Government Accountability Office, to look into Roswell. One of the most significant things they found, or rather they didn't find, was that every single outgoing message from the Roswell Army Air Force Base, as it was called at the time, from 1945 to 1949, 4 years, has vanished. I mean, nobody knows where they are. There's no surrounding documentation saying, you know, transfer these files to this base or that archive or destroy them or shred them. They're just not available. And even the people in the Air Force who did the search, like the archivists, they couldn't figure out who had removed the files or even when they'd been removed. You know, was it a month after Stephen Schiff made the inquiries or was it 30 or 40 years ago? Nobody was able to answer the questions, again suggesting, to me at least, you know, that the archivists and the Air Force aren't the bad guys in this. I really don't believe they are, but it's almost, again, as if there's this far more powerful hidden hand that sort of just moves in, you know, and takes what it needs without official oversight, and which even leaves, you know, the people in the agency scratching their heads. And so the Rendlesham saga is sort of eerily parallels what happened with the Roswell files as well.
In your best estimation, would you think that some of these files were missing right after the Freedom of Information Act in the States? Or do you think it's possible they were missing right off the bat, right after they happened?
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly with things like Rendlesham and Roswell, I think that whoever was responsible for sort of controlling the flow of information and investigating the events, I think they would sort of astutely have realized the importance of them and would have taken steps immediately to make sure that all the documentation and all the data was sort of consolidated in one place. You know, the last thing they would want or need is dozens of documents flying around all over the place with a chance of them then surfacing. So my view is that whatever happened at Roswell, I think those files were probably put together and held in one location since 1947. Now, maybe the location has changed since then, but I would be surprised if the files had been sort of split up and shared here, there, and everywhere. You know, that's sort of not the way things are done when it comes to like a classified project or program. You know, they're sort of held in one place. And I think that's what makes it difficult for us to find the files, because number one, we don't know who's holding them. Number two, we don't know which archive they're held at or agency or official body. And number three, the official story is, well, we can't find the files anyway, you know, so that makes it even more difficult to try and figure out how we get them.
There's no Project Blue Book in the States. You wonder where these files go today when there's a major sighting, enough for whoever it is to pay attention to in our government, where those files go.
Yeah, and I think for me, again, this sort of smacks of the idea that there's this sort of shadow group, because I think if it was for the regular Air Force or the CIL or whoever, you know, at least some of this latter-day material would be surfacing, but it clearly isn't. So, you know, we talk about well, we hear a lot about things like black budget projects and what are called SAPs or special access programs, where even, for example, you know, Congress and the Senate and very often even the president, you know, isn't fully aware of what's going on within these organizations because they're so sensitive and covered by national security issues that pretty much everybody, other than the people on the project itself, are totally out of the loop. And so I think that's why we're not seeing, you know, too much surfacing today. As I said, you know, I don't paint the Air Force or whoever's the bad guys hiding the truth, because I think even they don't really know, you know, what's going on. It is some sort of deeply buried group that possibly even officially doesn't exist. You know, it's perhaps the funding comes through sort of under the table methods and nothing's put down in writing, you know, in terms of a paper trail to find them. And that's what makes it so successful, I think.
Absolutely. And yeah, I've thought of that too, because there's a lot of money spent that there's no records of where it's going to, sort of black ops type of stuff. The thing that comes to mind is someone is filing for a UFO document through the Freedom of Information Act. They get it in the mail eventually, and it's blacked out. A lot of it's blacked out. Who is doing the blacking out, and what are the, you know, what could they possibly be reading? Someone is reading it within that branch of the government.
Yeah, well, what happens when you file a Freedom of Information request? If the files are identified and located, they go to a particular department that studies, if the file's not been released before, I should say, they study it to determine what material within that document can be released and the material that can't be released. Now, sometimes it's for down-to-earth reasons. For example, you know, if the file's, say, only 3 or 4 years old and it mentions the name of an active agent within that agency, they will black that name out because, you know, for national security reasons, they don't want people knowing who, you know, the names of serving military personnel or agency personnel. You know, the last thing they want, I guess, is somebody knocking on the doorstep of somebody who holds a sensitive position. So for that reason, sort of national security and personal privacy and personal safety of the relevant employee, the names will be withheld. There's also a portion of the Freedom of Information Act that allows all medical information on a person to be withheld from a document as well, you know, sort of private medical background, that sort of thing. But then you have what's called the classification B1, and B1 covers national security. So if there's anything in the document that has an effect or significant effect on national security, then that can be blacked out under the terms of the B1 aspect of the Freedom of Information Act. And so, in other words, the people who review the files have a high enough clearance to where they are allowed to read the material, and then a determination is made within the agency and other departments as to whether or not that data can be released. Now, obviously, in latter-day files, more often than not, anything with an effect on national security gets withheld. But if you look back at some of the earlier files from, say, the 50s and 60s, where perhaps the secret involved, you know, not necessarily a UFO secret, but whatever it was, you know, isn't necessarily relative to today, it's sort of 50, 40 years old, that often that material will be released because it has no sort of ongoing effect in today's world. So it very much depends on the content and the age of the documents and, you know, how decisions are made to whether or not it's going to impact upon national security if it's released or not.
Now, going across the board and all that you researched for this particular book, what do you think is the most intriguing missing files?
Well, I mean, for me, one of the most fascinating stories, and it's a controversial one, relates to Marilyn Monroe and her death in 1962, which, you know, a lot of people still view as a suspicious event, not just sort of an accident or suicide, but outright murder. The FBI have actually been very good about releasing all their files on Marilyn Monroe. You can find them at their website called The Vault. And again, this is why I don't paint, you know, the government agencies as the bad guys, because the FBI has been very good, as I said, at releasing their files. But we do still get these stories about, you know, the idea that she was murdered and, you know, possibly by government agents, some people say. Others suggest, again, like some shadow group that has hired assassins on its books, you know, and to where there's like plausible deniability because there's actually no direct government involvement. It's sort of, you know, farmed out to hired hands, so to speak. But the story is, very controversial story, suggests that when Marilyn Monroe was having an affair with President Kennedy in the early 1960s, that he supposedly confided in her details of various government secrets, presumably trying to impress her into the bedroom, so to speak. And these related to things like the Cuban Missile Crisis and the Bay of Pigs invasion that, you know, was the planned invasion of Cuba, and the relationship with the Russians. And one of the stories is that Kennedy supposedly told her about a secret trip he made to what he described as a secret air base, where he was shown, quote, bodies and things from outer space. You know, sort of the implication being, at least, that it was wreckage akin to sort of what was found at Roswell and bodies and so forth. And she supposedly wrote this in what she called her Diary of Secrets. And Marilyn Monroe did actually have this sort of Diary of Secrets, as it was called. You know, a lot of people portray her as like this sort of dumb, crazy blonde, but she actually wasn't. She had a deep interest in politics and, you know, the world stage, etc. And she had a great memory, and she would write all this stuff down that the Kennedys told her and that she got from other sources as well. And all we know for sure is that after her death in August 62, her diary, people who worked in the coroner's office said it was taken in there with all her, you know, her private belongings, but it vanished after a couple of days and nobody knew what happened to it. And it's not been seen since. But it was sort of like a hefty leather-bound journal. And she supposedly over the years had a number of these, but there was this particular one that sort of chronicled everything that the Kennedys told her. And again, this sort of demonstrates kind of a similar angle where it's not government files that have vanished, but it's a private journal from someone talking about government files. And again, you know, to what extent we might ever know what happened to that journal, you know, we just don't know. I'd be surprised if it was destroyed, because clearly whoever took it would want to know, you know, what she was exactly told and who else might have been told the information. So clearly it would have been studied as like a forensic document by the agencies, I think. But for me, that's one of the most fascinating ones, because, you know, Marilyn Monroe is like an American icon. She's become almost like legendary. And I think in that sense, that's why the intrigue surrounding this story continues to go on. You know, it'll never really die away.
Right. I can back that up about Marilyn Monroe, because I went over some unknown documents of hers about two or three years ago, and she was absolutely brilliant. I was kind of shocked after reading some of her notes. And no one could ever make a fake journal and put it out there, because her handwriting is very unique. She was a very intense person, and she absolutely wrote down everything that was in her mind. Some of the things I read kind of blew me away. And,
She was a very, very, very clever, intelligent, witty person. This image, you know, sort of like the crazy Hollywood blonde. And I think her big downfall was that she was very emotional and, you know, at times emotionally unstable. And that sort of, you know, worked against her. If she didn't have that aspect to her character, you know, I don't think she probably would have ended up how she did. But unfortunately, you know, she did, but that didn't take away the fact that, I mean, she took a great deal of notice, you know, of world politics and things like that. So.
Yeah. Well, Nick, this has been really intriguing. It's been a real enjoyable talk with you today. I've really, really liked it a lot.
Oh, well, thanks, Martin. I appreciate having me on the show. Thanks.
And what is your website?
Well, people can read from me at nickredfern14, which is FORTEAN, nickredfern14.blogspot.com. Or people can reach me on Facebook if you type Nick Redfern in. There are a few Nick Redferns, but scroll down and you'll find me on the list.
Okay. And you said you always have a book or two in the works. Do you have any working titles you're working on now?
Yeah, I've got one which comes out in June of next year. It's called Close Encounters of the Fatal Kind, and it's all about mysterious deaths within the UFO field of researchers and witnesses and people like that. So.
I had a conversation with Peter Robbins about that situation. That's very interesting.
Yeah, it's one that often sort of gets, it gets touched on, but a lot of people dismiss it as, oh, well, that's just too over the top. But when you look into it, you actually find there are a lot of very weird and sinister deaths in the field going way back to the 1940s even.
Right, right. All right, so thanks so much.
All right. Well, thanks, Martin. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to our show, and please remember to check out our website, podcastufo.com, for the latest blogs and forums. We will be back next week. Thanks again, and remember, keep your eyes to the sky.